Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, most of us, especially those listeners living in Florida, have heard of the Miami Circle, an archaeological site discovered about 25 years ago at the confluence where the Miami River empties into the Biscayne Bay. And it's thought to be about 2,000 years old. It consists of a circle of post holes dug into the limestone bedrock that appear to be the supports for a large, I guess, ceremonial building is the thinking. And since it was located on some of the most high-value real estate in the world, it was a tug-of-war for a good while between the developers and archaeologists, but that was eventually settled. A couple of years ago, though, an even bigger and much older site was discovered adjacent to the Miami Circle, and it has occasioned quite a bit of drama between the developer, the city of Miami, and archaeologists, and even local residents who want to see this ancient history preserved. My guest today is Dr. William Pessel, an archaeologist and chairman of the anthropology department at the University of Miami. He's not directly involved in the excavation project itself, but is involved in the effort to protect the site, and he'll tell us the whole story. Welcome, Dr. Pessel.
Thanks, Court. Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here today.
Yeah, appreciate having you on. If you don't mind, I'll call you Will.
That's fine. That is my name. Only my misbehaving students have to call me Dr. Pessel. So.
There you go. Well, first, why don't we just plunge in and tell us about the site itself, I mean, how it was found and so on.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, that whole area at the mouth of the Miami River has long been known to have been an archaeological site. I mean, going back to the 1950s, there has been archaeological work in that area that has made it quite clear that there was a settlement there that dated back into, you know, fairly deep prehistory. That archaeological evidence for the presence of a site is confirmed by historical attestation. So in the year 1513, Ponce de Leon, as part of his first visit to Florida, actually landed at the mouth of the river there and parlayed, made contact with the indigenous people that were living there then. And from them, he learned that they called themselves Tequesta. That was their ethnonym, the name that they gave themselves. And then, in fact, that the town or the village that was at the mouth of the river at that point was also called Tequesta. And this is thought to have been the capital of this indigenous group. And so, yeah, we've known for 6 or 7 decades that the mouth of the river has always been prime real estate, right? That it's always been the place that people in Miami have most desired to live because it gave the ancient indigenous folks that lived there easy access to the resources of the bay, but also an easy transportation route by a canoe up into the Everglades where they could hunt and gather to meet their other needs. And so this has long been known to been a site. And more recently, in the last 25 years, as you said, starting with the Miami Circle, there's been just an increasing pace of discoveries by archaeologists as, you know, mid-rise buildings from the middle part of the 20th century came down to be replaced by great big glass and steel skyscrapers. We've gotten a better and better sense of the lifeways of the people that lived there from, you know, as far ago as 2,000 or 2,500 years ago up until even several centuries after the arrival of Spanish colonial forces.
So on this very special site, there were some buildings that were, I guess you called them low-rise buildings, and then some more skyscraper-like buildings. But right now, there is another developer with new plans for it. So what are those plans for this site?
Yeah. So back about a decade ago, a very prominent Florida developer called the Related Group purchased 2 adjoining lots on the south side of the Miami River with plans for a great big mixed-use mega development. So, you know, when ultimately realized, this would include condominiums, would include a luxury hotel, you know, and presumably high-end retail, given sort of the character of that Brickell neighborhood as it's known now. So about 2 years ago, with the permission of the city, one of the 2 buildings, it was actually the old customs building on the south bank of the Miami River, was demolished. And yeah, so just about 2 years ago, archaeological work began. So to be clear, because this portion of downtown Miami is what is legally termed a high probability archaeological zone, right? Meaning that based on what we know and what we think we know, there is a high likelihood of there being archaeological materials in the area where this construction was planned. The developer was required to do some initial archaeological work, and that set in motion a series of sort of escalating archaeological phases that have culminated, and I guess are culminating, in the excavation, what we call the mitigation of a portion of this larger Tequesta site. So at the moment of, you know, our recording, excavations are ongoing at that site with archaeologists removing a midden, which is, you know, the fancy archaeological term that we give to sort of an accumulated garbage heap that provides evidence of all sorts of human activity going back thousands of years. And they're, you know, they're removing those sediments carefully and scientifically down to the level of the Miami bedrock, which at this site, just like at the Miami Circle, is you know, cut into with lots of ancient post holes from structures that would have existed there during the sort of Tequesta period of this site going back, again, a couple hundred to a couple thousand years.
So what has been, other than these post holes in the limestone bedrock, what's been found there so far as archaeological artifacts?
It's really been it's a treasure trove of artifacts. I mean, everybody knew that there was going to be archaeological material, and indeed the developer knew that they were going to be encountering archaeological material as they proceeded. But I think the richness of the finds in a number of different ways have been surprising. So what do we have? We have the foundations of the buildings, the houses and other structures that the ancient indigenous people would have occupied. We have the remains of the foods they ate. And this includes sort of a number of things that we would have expected. So, you know, deer bones, lots of evidence for fish and shellfish. But kind of surprisingly, we find evidence of the acquisition, the gathering, the hunting of certain marine animals that most likely were consumed in big feasting events where large groups of people would have gathered together. So they're the remains of large sea turtles, they're the remains of manatees, the remains of a now extinct seal called the West Indian monk seal. And even whales, right? There are whale bones coming out of this site. And, you know, you don't hunt or fish for a whale unless you're planning to feed a lot of people. Right? This is not a small daily meal, right? So this gives us a sense that there were large gatherings, large, you know, congregations of people on this site thousands of years ago. Ceramics, just enormous amounts of ceramics, you know, the fragments of the clay pots that they cooked their foods in and they ate them off of. And what's fascinating about some of these is that these are not just pottery that were made locally, right? But there are fragments of certain types of vessels that come from as far north as places like Jacksonville, right? And so this tells us that the ancient indigenous group that lived at this spot was not isolated, right? That they were in contact with all sorts of other indigenous peoples of the Florida Peninsula and beyond. And we get further confirmation of that in the form of stone projectile points and other stone tools. And you know, as someone who came from Florida, South Florida, you well know that all of the stone that we have available here is limestone, right? It's this marine limestone that the peninsula sits upon. You can't make arrowheads and spear points out of that material very well. And so the indigenous people, again, living in Tequesta would have traded with people from as far north as Georgia, Carolinas, and beyond for materials like chert or flint to make these stone tools. So again, they were connected, right, to a whole sort of southeastern complex of indigenous peoples throughout this region. But beyond that, there's even more. I mean, the story just keeps going and going. We live in this subtropical or neotropical zone here where we're lucky if organic things can survive for a couple of years, let alone a couple of millennia. And yet deep down in some of these solution holes in the limestone, archaeologists have recovered artifacts made out of wood, right? Artifacts made out of like things like cordage, right? So ropes that were made out of plant fibers. These are the kinds of things we've never before seen recovered from these sort of South Florida archaeological context because of you know, the prevailing climate, which just is incredibly hostile to organic preservation. And last but not least, in recent months and in sort of the closing stages of this excavation, what the excavators began to discover that was even more remarkable has been evidence of human occupation and activity of this area that doesn't just date back only 2,000 or 2,500 years, but that dates back far earlier to a period that archaeologists call the Archaic. And that goes back as far as 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. So now we're not saying that this site was necessarily continuously occupied from 7,000 years ago until the present moment, but there are artifacts, there's evidence of human activity on this site that goes back to 5,000 BC, which puts it on par with some of the earliest evidence yet recovered of human activity in South Florida. So we're talking evidence of some of the earliest peoples that ever lived in or ever roamed across southern Florida, all the way up through Spanish contact, all in one city block, right? So we have this continuous record of the entire indigenous history of Miami found in just this one relatively constrained space that's now hemmed in by skyscrapers and the river.
That's pretty amazing that it's that old. I mean, it goes back to like, you know, Babylon and Mesopotamia and things in the early part of the Bible, right? But is it surprising to archaeologists that a civilization like this, as extensive as you describe it to apparently have been, existed so early here in subtropical Florida? I mean, you know, like you said, I grew up in Miami and I can remember mosquitoes so thick, they look like fog. You know, in fact, B-52 bombers would fly low and slow over the city in a grid pattern, dropping DDT. It's surprising many of us are still alive. But I mean, is that you know, did that come as a big surprise in archaeology?
No, I mean, it's not a big surprise, I think, to the archaeological community, right? I mean, obviously, look, these folks had millennia to adapt to the unique challenges of life in South Florida, you know, the mosquitoes principal among those and the hurricanes, right? I mean, they would have had to have come up with ways to live in this unique environment. But keep in mind that, you know, there have been people in the Americas for, I mean, we're learning more and more every day, but 15, 20, 25,000 years, right? There have been people in Florida for 10, 12, 14, 15,000 years. So people had time to adapt and come up with, you know, sort of culturally appropriate practices. And whether this was, you know, keeping the home fires burning 24/7 to, you know, get that smoke in the air and keep the mosquitoes away, or, you know, applying different locally available plants. I mean, there's lots of methods, I think, that folks came up with to deal with that. But what isn't surprising about this, I think, for me and for a lot of other archaeologists that work in coastal environments, is that incredibly complex human societies can arise and can be supported by rich coastal resource bases, right? You mentioned Mesopotamia, right? You know, the Mesopotamian example, the sequence that we see is that plants and animals are domesticated and those become the economic base for these first cities, right, in the world, quote unquote. The economic base here in you know, coastal South Florida and in other parts of the world, you know, where there are these rich coastal resource bases, is that you don't need to be farmers to build a complex society. You need a reliable resource base, and the sea can provide that. And so I think if one had to predict, you know, where one might expect to find early evidence of humans in a zone such as this, it would be at one of these sort of these borders between ecological zones where you have the freshwater resources coming from the river and going up into the Everglades. You have the bay and with the ocean beyond, right? And this is, I think, this makes sense in terms of what we know of, you know, the hunter-gatherer, fisher-forager types of people who lived in this part of the Americas in this archaic period. This is a likely spot. It was good real estate back then, too.
Are there any estimates of how many people might have lived there back in those times? I mean, the early 5,000, 6,000 years ago period at its peak then?
Yeah, this is a number that we're really bad at estimating, because just there, even saying 5,000 to 7,000 years, you know, this is our initial estimate before sort of final processing and investigation of these artifacts have begun. And so pinpointing how many people would have been there at any one given period of time, one moment of time, like one human generation, is tough to do. I mean, for the Dacesta period, this more recent period, estimates range pretty wildly, right? So at the moment of Spanish contact, you know, there are estimates that go from the high hundreds to several thousand people. Now, would they all have been in this village year round? We don't know. It could have been seasonally occupied. You know, people could have been coming and going. And to be clear, these Dacesta people at the moment of contact were in contact, again, were in communication and were exchanging with indigenous people in southwestern Florida. So the Calusa people, they had, you know, political arrangements and relationships with people down in the Keys. And so they could have been moving, right, you know, between these various spots, such that it's really hard for us to put a specific number. But we're talking, you know, hundreds to thousands of people would have lived in this area at sort of its prehistoric peak.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. William Pessel, an archaeologist at the University of Miami, about a big and really pretty new archaeological find pretty much on the banks of the Miami River, where it empties into Biscayne Bay in Miami, right in the heart of Miami. And like all such things are destined to be, it's a tug of war between development and preservation, right? So let's go ahead and turn to that contentious issue. We talked about who owns the site now and kind of what their plans are for it, but is the company complying with city requirements for development in what you called a designated archaeological zone? Are they kind of, you know, checking off the boxes the way they should so far?
Yeah. So to be very clear, and you know, and obviously there I have lots of reasons, lots of motivation to be clear about this. To my knowledge, everything the developer has done thus far at the site has been completely legal. So, right, the related group owns this property. The related group has followed the city code of ordinances as it pertains to sort of the various archaeological steps they have taken to this point. And you know, and they've also been working with the state of Florida as is appropriate, particularly when it deals with a provision having to do with unmarked human graves, because there are human remains that have been recovered from the site, and this necessarily then involves state oversight. I mean, it probably comes as no great surprise to you that, you know, the laws when it comes to property and development in the state of Florida are, you know, very pro-property rights, very pro-development. And so while the developer has complied thus far, I think the legal standard that they've been held to has been minimal. And so, you know, what they have been required to do is the excavation of the site, which they have, you know, contracted out to a firm that provides this service for developers. And at the end of this process, that contracted firm will be required to produce probably a pretty perfunctory report on the findings from the site. You know, it'll list, you know, how many artifacts of type X, type Y, and type Z, but it won't necessarily go much farther than that. Just thinking about sort of the legal requirements on the developer, I mean, again, in Florida, those are quite minimal. I mean, people are sometimes shocked to hear this, but it's sad but true that the related group could literally turn around and sell all the artifacts that they've recovered from the site, with the exception of the human remains, on eBay, and that would be legal. They own this material, right? This is their property. And that, to me, right, creates a real ethical issue, right? And so what is clear, again, the developer has complied with the laws, but the city agencies, the city board that oversees these activities has relatively broad discretion, and they have not thus far chosen to exercise that to sort of pursue a potential better outcome from the site than mere excavation and then warehousing of the artifacts, which, to be clear, is what's going to happen if nothing were to change. And so, you know, because this is a high probability archaeological zone, as it's known, right, the developer had to do this work. But what we're trying to do, and trying to sort of leverage the public interest in the site to do, is to realize something better for the site, right? To say, look, the law in this case sets a floor, but it doesn't set a ceiling. And as, you know, a community that includes archaeologists, that includes folks that are interested in historic preservation, that includes living indigenous peoples, right? Is there an outcome for this site that better respects the history, that better respects historic preservation, while also letting the developer accomplish their necessary goals of building more luxury housing units and a hotel and retail? And so the city could have done more to this point. And I think looking forward, it seems like the city is inclined to do more. But thus far, it's been kind of a bare minimum approach, which is really in keeping with the long and sad history of Miami when it comes to matters of historic preservation.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're just kind of requiring them to meet the letter of the law. And in fact, the developer is doing just that, and they're being careful to do that and probably spending a lot of money on it from the look of things. You know, there are videos online that we'll talk about later. But I mean, there's a city archaeologist and an historic preservation director who are on the staff of the city of Miami, right? They're employees of the city. And, you know, they're probably between a rock and a hard place, or between limestone and mud, I guess, or something, but they
limestone and money, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine they're in a difficult position, but what has been their stance on this? If you can talk about it just kind of in a brief way.
No. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, the city has a historic preservation officer and an archaeologist who have been keeping tabs on this work and have been making sure that the necessary checkpoints have been met as this has progressed. But, you know, where the power really lies is with this city board called the Historic and Environmental Preservation Board, or HEP board. That board is empowered through the City of Miami's Code of Ordinances with the ability to, first of all, designate sites or properties with an official designation. Now, for a historic building, this would be, you know, we designate you as an official historic building. For an archaeological site, it would be to designate it as an official archaeological site or zone. This designation, which has not happened, to be clear, this is different from this thing called the high probability archaeological zone. If they were to designate this site, that would then put the HEP board in a position where they could place lots of conditions upon future development at the site, right? So far, the developer has knocked down one building, done excavations, which are almost concluded. There's a whole nother building that is yet to come down, under which there will be more of this same site. And so we're actually at a critical moment here where if the HEP board chooses to sort of follow through on some steps that they've initiated and to exercise their powers to sort of the further extent that they're able to do, we could actually see some really satisfactory sort of preservation outcomes for portions of this site. And so since February, at the instruction of the HEP board, the city's staff members, who you just mentioned, have been working with a group of archaeologists, myself included, and with other partners, including the Florida Public Archaeological Network, to make a case to the board that the site be designated, with the hopes that the board will then place conditions upon future development that would include perhaps setting aside a portion of the as yet untouched land, right, to preserve in situ, undisturbed, some portion of the site. Or if they're allowed to go ahead and build, that they have to alter their building plans in such a way that some portion of the site can be preserved in situ. They could also, the HEP board, place conditions upon the developer having to do with the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of artifacts that have already been excavated, to include things like you need to make sure that these go to a reputable museum or university to be curated and protected for the long term, that they be studied, and that ultimately the people of Miami learn something about these artifacts, about the history that they represent, right? So do they build an exhibit? Do they put together a curriculum that goes out to every Miami-Dade County Public School, you know, for their fourth grade civics lesson, Florida history lesson, so that they can learn about this bit of history that resides here and goes back thousands and thousands of years. And so the city staff and the HEP board have in recent months, I think in response to the public pressure, ramped up on their activity and interest. But until recently, I think that I would characterize them again as sort of ticking those sort of minimum boxes. Their motivations, I don't want to cast any aspersions, but they haven't been doing much more than the mandatory minimum until quite recently, but we're happy to see that the tone of things is changing in recent months.
Well, Will, we're getting kind of toward the end of the show, but so just sort of briefly, I gather that the city issued construction permits for this big project before any archaeological work was done, even knowing that it was almost certainly a site of archaeological significance, even a major site. So were they, in your view, I'll put the ball in your court here. Were they right to do that, to issue those permits before even knowing what was there for sure?
I think, I would even sort of invert that a little bit and say the developer knew without a doubt that there was going to be an archaeological site there. They were told this before, you know, when they purchased the land and planned development. So nobody should have been surprised. I can't speak as to whether or not the city was legally right. The way that the code is written, my guess is that, you know, the lawyers could find a way to justify the actions that were taken. I will say that If one is going to be really serious about historical preservation and one is going to see this as a matter in which the community needs to be more fully involved, it was not the right thing to do, right? There should have been, you know, some attempt to sort of sit back and see what the significance of the site was before construction permits were granted, before, you know, cement was allowed to be pumped into the earth, which is what's going on right now. So, you know, legally, that's a question for somebody else. Ethically and morally, I don't think it was the right thing to do.
You know, is there a chance that the site could be included in the National Register of Historic Places, as the Miami Circle is, which is much smaller again? So, and if it were to be, how would that affect the outcome, just kind of briefly?
Yeah, so a National Register designation or a National Historic Landmark designation, which is what I think the Circle falls under, that is a wonderful designation, but it is ultimately kind of an honorific as compared to the local designation, which is actually where there are legal teeth. So somewhat sort of, you know, and people are confused about this oftentimes. It's really the local level protections that are most important in these cases. And so it's well established in the city's code of ordinances that the city could designate this space and that would put in place all of these legally enforceable mechanisms to sort of constrain future development and come up with creative solutions as to what to do with the materials that go forward. So this is really a matter that I think is best dealt with at this local level. And the laws are there if the board chooses to exercise its power.
So kind of two related questions. First, what kind of preservation would you ideally like to see done here within the realm of reality, given the situation?
Look, I think that my ideal outcome for this site would have two components. For the portion which has not yet had a shovel put into it, right, where there is still this 20th century mid-rise building sitting atop it, I would like to see that building come down and I would like to see that lot preserved as green space. I think that this would, first of all, respect what I have heard so far coming from a number of prominent voices in the local indigenous community, and it would preserve for the future untouched this bit of Miami's history, right? The circle across Biscayne Avenue there received its designation after it was already excavated. I think having a portion of the site that would just sit unexcavated is actually a really satisfactory outcome because archaeological methods have improved so dramatically in the last 50 to 70 years. We can do so much more with so much less destruction and disruption that 50 to 100, 200 years from now, assuming that this isn't all underwater, archaeologists could do a whole lot of non-destructive study of this site if a portion of it were preserved intact, and would also be a fitting memorial and a spot for Miamians and tourists from outside the city to come visit. Part two for me would be that there has to be a better outcome for those hundreds of thousands of artifacts that have already come out of the ground than simply sitting in a warehouse gathering dust somewhere. And so I would hope that the city would see fit to require the developer to turn over those artifacts to a reputable museum or university, and to provide the funds to protect those things, store them for the long term, and study them, and ultimately, again, disseminate those findings. There's no point in just holding on to this stuff if it's only us archaeologist nerds talking to each other about it. The public deserves to know about this. This is our shared history as residents of South Florida. And so there has to be a way to push that information back out into the public through exhibitions, through fantastic websites, through curricula, whatever it is, the public needs to know. And I think that is, again, within the realm of the possible and the achievable if public officials are held to account here.
So the second part of my question, and if it's not fair to ask you this, to answer it in 30 seconds or so, which is about all the time we have left, but realistically, what's your best guess as to how this will actually turn out?
I think the negative side of me says that if the HEP board follows the previous sad precedents, that the developer will present a plan that's full of promises, but that will be ultimately legally unenforceable, and that much of the site will be destroyed and not a whole lot will happen positively with these artifacts. I think, however, public pressure is such that there will probably be some sort of compromise solution wherein some portion of the site that is as yet unexcavated will be preserved, and that some sort of middle ground compromise solution will be come up with for the artifacts, for their study and for their interpretation or dissemination. But the line that I keep thinking about in my head is that only in Miami would we be having this discussion about what portion of the site are we okay with destroying, right? If this was the Colosseum in Rome, which again, this predates the Colosseum in Rome by millennia, we wouldn't say we're okay with destroying 50% of it for this new hotel. No, we would say preserve the whole damn thing. And honestly, I think that that is the outcome that we all have to continue to push for.
Well, I doubt that Miami is the only place this would happen, but we do have to wrap it up here. And I think that, you know, a compromise of some sort is likely. It's always, as in all of these situations, a case of where the football ends and somewhere in the middle of the field, right? So hopefully it'll turn out in somewhat toward the positive end of your idealistic view of it. But I want to thank you so much for being on with us, Dr. William Pessel. And for all of you listening, if you want to go to YouTube and search the phrase Miami River Archaeological Discovery, you'll find a couple of videos of the ongoing work and actually an interview with Will Pessel there in person. And it's very interesting. So again, thanks so much for being on with us.
Thank you so much, Court. I really appreciate your attention to this really important matter. And I thank your listeners for their time and their patience.
Yeah, it was interesting. I enjoyed it. And I want to thank all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.